Hello, I'm Barbara Peters, and I'm about to converse with Priscilla Royal, author of how many now, Priscilla?
14.
Why is 12 stuck in my head? Medieval Mysteries. It is Saturday, February 24th, and we have just had a party to launch Wild Justice. That's a great title. Where'd you come up with it?
It was actually from a quote that discussed fear, but I was interested in having Prioress Eleanor deal with a case that perhaps she did not, in her mind, satisfactorily resolve. And because it was the kind of crime it was, the kind of justice was best described as wild.
Rather than conventional, or conventional.
Yes.
In, what year are we in now, 13
12,
what?
1282.
Oh, 1282.
Yes.
Okay. How did I lose a few years there?
For because I jumped ahead 3 years.
That explains it. Thank you very much. Yes. It isn't just me. Okay. So once again, although Eleanor and Brother Thomas and Sister Anne and all are part of a priory located near Norfolk.
Yes.
In the northeast, well.
East Anglia.
East Anglia. In order to avoid the whole Cabot Cove syndrome of too many people dying in too small a place.
Yes.
You have her journey around to various parts of England, which she can credibly do to visit her family.
Yes.
And in this particular book, what is the setup for her being away from home?
The setup is that we have gotten into the Welsh Wars with Llewellyn and Edward I. And Eleanor's oldest brother, who is now Baron Hugh because their father has died, is going to go off to join the army to help fight against the Welsh. Which, of course, means that there is a possibility he may die.
Right.
Which is why she's visiting him to begin with. And at that particular time, he asks a favor of her, which, of course, she's going to grant, saying, I have a gift of rents and a personal letter I want you to take to Prioress Amicia, who is the head of the only Hospitaller nuns priory in England, which was settled in Somerset. And I want you to give these specifically to Prioress Amicia, no one else. So when Prioress Eleanor and crew arrive at the priory, they discover that Prioress Amicia has been put in a cell and has been convicted of murder. And the new prioress, Prioress Emmeline, is the one that Eleanor must speak to. Eleanor knows that the letter is personal, but she figures she's going to have to disobey her brother's request. Obviously, she's not going to give it to Prioress Amicia. So she said, here are the rents, but I would like to at least honor my brother's request and see Prioress Amicia, because I'm assuming they're very good friends, or they knew each other. And I need to at least speak with her. So she's granted permission. She goes up to the cell, and Prioress Amicia is a woman who is older, very fragile looking, and obviously resigned to her fate. Eleanor gives her the letter, and Prioress Amicia reads it, bursts into tears, and says, please, I am innocent. Prove me innocent.
Wow, so we have to overcome a confession.
Yes.
There's no forensic evidence here. Yeah. The body is long gone.
Right.
That's going to be an extremely difficult task.
It is, and she also has a situation where she can't offend anybody, and Prioress Emmeline has made it very clear that she is not too thrilled about Prioress Eleanor being there.
So we kind of assume, this being a crime novel, that all is perhaps not as it should be.
That's correct.
And what's it called? Munchin Buckhead?
Munchin Buckland.
Oh, I was close. Yeah. Munchin Buckland. Okay. Which, as you said, is an order of nuns of the Knights Hospitaller. And what is their primary function?
Their primary function that we usually hear about is the military order. They were like the Templars in that sense. They did have a knights, brother knights and brother sergeants who fought in the Holy Land, but their primary purpose, unlike the Templars, was originally to be a charitable order and an order concerned with healing. So that why they became a military order is probably more due to the fact that everybody else was doing it and that's how they got money. But their hospital, beginning in Jerusalem and then later after Jerusalem was lost in Acre, was their primary function, that they would provide medical care for anybody who needed it, and it was an extremely expensive proposition. People had individual beds. They were actually feather beds. Linen was washed frequently. If you needed to go to the bathroom, somebody would take you. If your feet needed tending, they would soak them and remove calluses with pumice. They had a tremendous amount of individual care, and they had a very good diet of fresh meat, fresh vegetables, and fresh fruit. And so it was an expensive proposition.
Could I interrupt you for just a second to ask you this? They're called the Knights Hospitaller,
right,
which can be taken one of two ways, mm-hmm. i.e. they ran hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
But also, in my experience, religious orders were basically the social network of their day. Mm-hmm. And so they also were the place that took care of travelers, took care of pilgrims, took care of visitors, whatever. So hospitality, mm-hmm. as opposed to hospital. Mm-hmm. Did they do both?
Not exactly. It's really St. John of Hospital of Jerusalem. That's where they actually got their name.
Okay, so hospitallers because of the hospital.
Right, because of the hospital. Now, as far as taking care of people, if they needed medical care, yes, but they didn't have like inns or
right.
places where people could stay.
Well, you're often compared to Ellis Peters and her brother Cadfael Mysteries, which I personally think is an incredible compliment, so bravo to you. But it's, you know, I've read all 20 of Brother Cadfael's, and it was always part of the function of his religious establishment to take care of, you know, travelers, I mean, or to people
yeah.
who were, I mean, it was a whole variety of things, but
yeah.
basically there were no public services.
No, but this was very true of priories and monasteries and what have you all the way through Europe. If some traveler came, they were given bed and board, if you will.
Right.
But with the Hospitallers in particular, it was essentially, they ran a hospital. They did have some charitable aspects, but they were mostly related to the poor.
Okay.
They were called they called themselves serfs of the poor.
So they needed money.
They needed money. They needed a tremendous amount of money, but they would go out into the city and bring in people who needed medical care and that sort of thing. But that was their primary function.
Okay. So if we have, in fact, a group of nuns in Somerset, mm-hmm. what is their primary function? Is it to send money back to the
yes.
London headquarters? This is the only Knights Hospitaller nunnery, so to speak, in England, right?
That is correct. And that was because Henry II decided that it would be a good idea, because I think Henry II did everything, to consolidate, because part of the problem, and this was due to the church as well, was that there was a growing discomfort with men and women religious living together or living in close proximity. With the Hospitallers, usually the situation was you had a commandery, which was what they called their monasteries, large number of men and a very small number of women. So it made sense to say, okay, let's take all the women in England and plunk them in one place.
Okay. But this being a crime novel,
mm-hmm.
it's good to introduce the idea of a flow of money.
Yes. And actually, yes, their primary function was to be profitable, so they could send a certain portion, like a tithe, if you will, as much money as they could beyond their maintenance, to the prior of England who lived in Clerkenwell.
Right.
And then he distributed the money.
So here's Eleanor, and on her travels, she's most often accompanied by Brother Thomas,
mm-hmm.
of whom we will speak. But more and more so, Sister Anne is always part of this, and
mm-hmm.
she's really useful in crime fiction, isn't she? Because somebody needs to have some idea about forensics.
Yes, and she does. She's an interesting woman because her father was a physician. And because he had no sons, and he loved his daughter, and this is not unusual, despite a lot of our misconceptions about medieval parents with their children, and particularly fathers with daughters, he taught her a lot about medicine.
And she was probably useful to him, too.
She was very useful, and when she married, her husband was an apothecary. She became his assistant, although she was more talented than he. Then he found a vocation and decided that he would join the Order of Fontainebleau. And because she essentially couldn't get remarried because she couldn't divorce him, she joined the same order.
Right, which in fact, and I'm not suggesting in any way this is a copycat, mm-hmm. was one of Ellis Peters, I think, more harrowing Brother mm-hmm. Cadwell's. I think it was number 17, although I might be wrong here. But it was the same problem, is that a husband decided to go for a religious vocation mm-hmm. and enter a religious order. Mm-hmm. And the wife was left in limbo.
Right.
Not a wife, not a widow. Mm-hmm. And what was he or she to do? Ellis Peters took a much different solution. But mm-hmm. Sister Anne decided to enter the monastery mm-hmm. also.
Yes.
And now has become a very important figure for Eleanor, yeah. and frequently goes on travels with her. Mm-hmm. A question that occurs to me that I have never asked you.
Yes.
How does the order back in Norfolk, or back, you know, in mm-hmm. East Anglia, how does it operate when Eleanor and Sister Anne are gone?
Well, first of all, Eleanor will have a sub-prioress.
Okay.
Now, in the past, it's been Sister Ruth, and Sister Ruth, for various reasons, no longer wishes to be sub-prioress.
Which has been a thread in the books, right?
Prior book. And Eleanor has not really found somebody, so I've not been specific about who she's appointed in her absence, but she would appoint someone.
Right.
Now, as far as Sister Anne is concerned, she's actually the sub-infirmarian. The infirmarian herself is a woman who is more prone to prayer than she is to medicine, although the two women actually work very well together. Sister Anne, however, is teaching somebody, and so when she's gone, it's Sister Oliva, who is her protege, if you will, right. who she's training.
Well, I asked you this question just because, you know, somebody may wonder, well, if they're off on their travels, mm-hmm. you know, what happens back? And in point of fact, there's a very good, I don't want to say bureaucracy, but, you know, there's a team
that is
back at the monastery. At the priory. So Eleanor can go off and take along mm-hmm. both Brother Thomas and Sister Anne or whomever
right.
without seriously crippling the everyday workings of the priory.
Well, she also has a prior, because this is a double house.
Right.
And he is actually subordinate to her because of the way the Order of Fontainebleau was set up. But he handles a lot of the finances and does a lot of the traveling to do things like checking on the sheep and the rents and that sort of thing, which are things that she really can't do all that effectively, but he can. He's very good at it.
Well, these have been problems, and there's a lot of mysteries, long-time series, where someone has a profession today, not really a vocation, but, mm-hmm. you know, a profession. And when they go off sleuthing, mm-hmm. who's running it?
Yeah.
You know, who's
mm-hmm.
who's running the chocolate shop, or who's running
yes.
the bookstore, or whatever? And I think, you know, one reason, for a while there was a real popularity in contemporary mysteries of clerical sleuths. You had mm-hmm. Rabbi Winter. You
right.
had, you know, Father Brown, famously,
mm-hmm.
whatever.
Yes.
And they had two advantages. One, they were paid by some entities so
mm-hmm.
that their sleuthing did not cripple them economically.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But the institution they served was also going on okay in their absence,
yeah.
as opposed to somebody running, let's say, an independent business of
mm-hmm.
some sort.
Yeah.
So I think you've done really well with the structure behind, mm-hmm. you know, this series, is that they can either be at the Priory or they can be somewhere in England.
Mm-hmm.
And so far you haven't taken them out of England.
I probably won't, because, first of all, travel across the Channel was not exactly the safest thing on the face of the earth. Now, the mother house, of course, is in Anjou, where the Abbess and the Order and Fontainebleau Abbey are. Which is very, very tempting, but I think I, at least for the foreseeable future, and I'm not dismissing anything
right.
at this point, I have a lot to deal with as far as English politics and Edward I and the impact he had on his subjects.
Absolutely. In fact, I didn't say, but you've transitioned us from Henry III, who was a long
mm-hmm.
life but not particularly effective king,
mm-hmm.
to his son Edward I,
mm-hmm.
who was known as the lawgiver, who mm-hmm. was a very strong... Plantagenets went that way, didn't they? They would have like Henry II or mm-hmm. Edward I, mm-hmm. and then they would have these kind of placeholders mm-hmm. in between.
It was almost a generational thing. You had Henry II, and then, of course, you know, I mean, not leaving Richard and whatever, but you had John, who in some respects was very strong. He's just had his issues. Then we had Henry III, who's not considered to be one of England's finest kings. Then we had Edward I. Then we have Edward II, who is
a low point.
Who was yes, not one of the more exciting, right. or I mean, he may be exciting, but not one of the more important ones. And then we have his son Edward III,
who was a good king for a long time, but lived too long.
Yes, exactly, and I think apparently had Alzheimer's, or at least a form of dementia.
I imagine that he did. He and Henry III would be better remembered if their lives had been shorter in terms of how they governed. But anyway, so here we are with Edward, who was warlike and who mm-hmm. took his war after the Crusades. He was taking his wars to Wales, mm-hmm. and then he's going to take them to Scotland, because we actually think of him also as the hammer of the Scot, in addition to being the lawgiver. Mm-hmm. And he's very much married to his queen mm-hmm. From Spain,
mm-hmm. Eleanor,
right, who, you know, is the reason we have Charing Cross and all, because he erected crosses to her mm-hmm. and her funeral cortege back to London, if I remember right. Anyway, it's a dynamic and very interesting period that you are writing about, and lots going on in England, so... Mm-hmm. On the other hand, it would be interesting, you know, if Eleanor at some point did have to go to the mothership back mm-hmm. in Anjou. Mm-hmm. Maybe, you know, some trauma will mm-hmm. force her to do that, cross the channel and mm-hmm. all the rest.
Well, let's say, I haven't discounted it. It's just not something that I was particularly right. planning for.
So, Brother Thomas, he yes. is in many ways the most interesting character to me in this book. He did not come to a religious vocation because he had one, but rather because he was forced into it.
That's very true. And his story, I mean, I'm glad you find him interesting, because I find him one of the more complex characters in many respects. He is an illegitimate son of a nobleman who has remained unnamed and will continue to remain unnamed, and a mother who died when he was quite young. He gained his father's affection, but being an illegitimate son, he decided that probably he would be better off with a job in the church, if you will, in minor orders. So that's how Thomas started out. Unfortunately, Thomas, and this was a world in which there was no name for such a thing, not even sodomite, because sodomite meant anything except the, you know, one approved manner of sexuality. He's gay.
He is gay at a time when that was a death sentence.
Yes, it was beginning to be a death sentence.
Right.
And he is caught in the act, thrown in prison, and is saved in essence by a man who is a man in black robes, if you will.
Kind of a shadowy secret agent.
Yes.
I love him, because we don't mm-hmm. really know what he's all about. No. But he's given a choice, right?
He's
he can
choice.
Take orders or mm-hmm. languish there in prison or lose his head, however
right.
it was going to go.
Right, burn at the stake, probably.
Yeah.
So Thomas figures he doesn't have a choice, and he's sent off to this little obscure, as far as he's concerned, because he's a Londoner, obscure fish-smelling place on the coast of East Anglia, and he hates it. He has no, he's lost the person he loves.
He's lost the man he loves.
He loves the man he loves. And he's now faced with having to obey a woman, which in many respects, he just sort of said, why? He doesn't even like Eleanor, initially.
Very true. Well, I mean, it works out extremely well in that they can become a team without a lot of sexual tension. Although, right. although Eleanor, who is young, mm-hmm. sincere in her vocation, mm-hmm. but nonetheless ardent, mm-hmm. Really falls for Brother Thomas, and yes. ironically has no idea no. that of all the people observing a vow of chastity at mm-hmm. the Priory, mm-hmm. he's having the easiest time of it. You know, he's in a group of women. He doesn't care.
No, he doesn't.
So, I mean, there's some really interesting irony in it, but I like the way that you have grown them, you know, into mm-hmm. their roles and into a real partnership mm-hmm. and a real loving friendship, mm-hmm. you know?
It is a real loving friendship. And I think one of the fun things to deal with, and not necessarily from a romantic point of view, but what is the nature of love? It has so many manifestations, and it can be incredibly complex. And yes, Eleanor and Thomas learned to love each other very deeply. She, obviously, you can't stay at a white heat forever. So at a certain point in the series, she has to come to terms with this. And she does, in the course so far of what I've written. That doesn't mean that she feels any less for him, but there's not that white heat, and it evolves into something of a deep appreciation, and really a bond that a good marriage between husband and wives, there's an element of that kind of deep bond.
Right.
So, meanwhile, of course, Thomas has his own issues. He continues to have his own issues. He thinks he's found somebody that he cares about, but obviously a sexual relationship is not possible. And he's having, he's going to have issues. It's not going to be easy for Thomas.
No, it shouldn't be easy for Thomas. It's a very difficult position. But what you've assembled here is really a very good team. You have Eleanor, who is powerful, and you know, you've got Thomas, who has his set of skills. You've got Sister Anne with her set of skills. You bring in other characters. But it really has made it possible to keep 14 books fresh, you know, that everybody develops. It's not static. They move around. And you bring us to various aspects of medieval life, some of which a lot of people might not be familiar with. There's the relationship between Christians and Jews. Edward has a... Edward's always looking for money. So the Jews become a kind of source of revenue for him. I don't know that he was anti-Semitic so much as he just needed constant money. We have Eleanor's older brother, Hugh, is suffering from PTSD as a crusader. You've got him to deal with. He has an illegitimate son, sort of mirroring Thomas. He's off studying law. There's going to be possibilities there. Women at the priory are aging. You have taken us to other priories to look at manuscripts. We've looked at castles. We've looked at war. We've looked at all kinds of things. It was an amazingly complex society. And I think you've done a brilliant job in giving us a window into all kinds of aspects of it, which of course is why I loved Ellis Peters too.
Yes, well, that's one of the reasons I loved her too, and the complexity of Brother Catherine.
Right, except that he mostly stayed in Shrewsbury. And I like the fact that Eleanor and her team, as we say, are more mobile. I like going to Wales. I like going to different places. And I do think that the brother Cad, he'd done all that, and he'd come to rest in Shrewsbury.
Right.
So
Absolutely.
It wasn't that he was, you know, provincial,
no,
but he was now settled.
Well, not only that, but he wasn't the business manager.
No.
He wasn't the prioress situation, because they essentially, because they were totally dependent on their own ability to create funds and support themselves, they had to be good business managers. So actually, whether they were a prior or a prioress, either one spent a lot of time outside the priory making money.
Absolutely. And priory finances, if you've ever been to a chapter house and seen, you know, the way they sit, a lot of it depended, as you say, on rents, land grants, and so forth. It's an incredibly complex system.
Oh, yeah.
I think in many ways, one of my, if not my favorite, one of my favorite of all your books is the one where you explore music and a version of opera, which is
the
fabulous.
Daniel,
yes, you had such a good time with that. Do you see yourself looking for different cultural, you know, you've looked at books and you've looked at opera, and otherwise we're more at war and other things, but, you know, do you see some other cultural aspect, you know, painting, studies?
I think the idea of Hugh's son Richard being an attorney or being a lawyer is an interesting aspect, because he can deal with Edward the Lawyer King.
Right, and he can go to court. We have now an entree into actually the court, what we didn't previously have.
Yes, so I mean that's a possibility. I will say that I'm always intrigued by the things we least expect in the Middle Ages. So what I pick up on is something like the play of Daniel, where, gee, it's like a miniature opera. I never knew that. Even though I'd heard a lot of early music, that was one thing that I missed, and I saw a performance of it and was absolutely awed by it. So even the illuminated manuscript was by the Salisbury master, something that is little known but actually exists. It lives in a museum. And or the Hospitallers, because nobody really thinks about the Hospitallers. It's the Templars that are
very true. So can I throw one out here? Just sure. A personal passion for me.
Mm-hmm.
Stained glass.
Oh, okay.
Stained glass windows. Okay. Rob and I have spent like 2 days at Chartres.
Mm-hmm.
He with his camera, me lying flat on benches with binoculars. We had to go back because the first time we went, it was raining and without the sun,
mm-hmm.
you couldn't see. So we had to make a return trip. Saint-Chapelle in Paris,
mm-hmm.
All over England. I think, Ken Follett did such a wonderful job building a cathedral,
yes.
But I've always, and the rose window at York is incredible.
Mm-hmm.
But I myself think that the stained glass, the artistry in it, the craft in it, the lead, the glass, all the rest of it would be so interesting if you were ever able to bring yourself to look at it.
Well, I think in many respects it's a good idea because I happen to have a fondness for craft of various ilks. I have some excellent books on medieval craft, goldsmithing and what have you. Certainly stained glass, and I can certainly see doing something like that too, because once again, it's not something that's commonly dealt with.
No, it's not. We know a lot more. We're more familiar with the Bayeux tapestry. I mean, that's another whole thing, was incredible embroidery or storytelling through. I mean, I think the Bayeux tapestry, which I thought I would not enjoy when I went to see it in France and absolutely was riveted to it, is a remarkable way to chronicle, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different art form than words. It's a different art form than film, and they were masters of needlework as well as stained glass.
Absolutely, and not only that, but because the majority of the populace was illiterate, visual was very important to teaching lessons or teaching history. For the same reason that memories were very much better than they are now, because everybody memorized everything.
You're right. It was an oral all the way back to Homer,
absolutely.
Which was why he had mnemonics in it. I never told you about my granddaughter when she was 8. I took her to the cloisters in New York, the museum.
Mm-hmm.
I thought she would be really bored. We went up there really to see the Palisades, and it was snowing, all that good stuff. She was riveted by the art, and I realized that she knew the stories that she could tell. But here's what happened. We went into the Unicorn Tapestry Room, which I have been to I don't know how many times, which is the centerpiece of the cloisters.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm standing there showing her to us, and she looks all around the room, and she looks at me, and she said, "Grandma, they're not hung in the right order."
Oh, my heavens.
And my mouth dropped open, and there was a curator over to the side who came over and said, "Did I hear your granddaughter right?" And I said, "She says they're not hung in order." And the woman looked around, she said, "She's absolutely right." And we realized that the reason was they had to cut the tapestries to fit the room.
Oh.
And the order of the tapestries, therefore, was interrupted.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, I have been there, probably a dozen times and had never noticed.
Mm-hmm.
I took my 8-year-old who was really into the story of
yes,
the tapestry,
exactly.
not the beauty of the tapestry
no.
or the artistry
no.
of the tapestry, to say the story is not flowing like it should.
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, I think, Priscilla, you and I are going to have a wonderful time for as long as this lasts, right?
I think so too.
Absolutely. It's really a pleasure to talk to you, and I will look forward to seeing what you're going to present me with next.